You know, as we speak with Robert Zubrin about space, Buzz Aldrin, the second man to walk on the moon, just turned 92 today. How about that? Happy birthday, Buzz. Many, many more for you. We're going to come back and take calls and continue chatting with Robert Zubrin about space on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Robert Zubrin with us. George Norrie here with us. That amazing Buzz Aldrin turned 92 as we continue talking tonight, Robert.
Okay. Yeah. Well, happy birthday, Buzz.
And happy birthday, Buzz, indeed. And second man to be on the moon. Isn't that kind of cool? Just to think about that. Anyways, my question to you is, what other countries should we be concerned about in this continuing push for space?
Well, okay, it's a two-sided coin, you know, because being predominant in space is very important for our national defense. On the other hand, if other countries such as Russia or China wish to match us in space, they're going to have to become more free, okay? Because why isn't there a SpaceX in Russia? Okay, they have the talent, and there are people with a lot of money running around who actually believe in space.
And they've got the rocketry because they've been taking us up to the space station.
Yeah, but those are with old-fashioned Soviet rockets.
Yes, that's true.
But to create something like SpaceX, why can't they do it? It's because if anybody created a SpaceX in Russia, some thief in the Kremlin would steal their company. Okay? That is, there's just no rule of law. Okay? No one's going to make what someone else is just going to take from them. Okay? And the same thing is true with China. In other words, these countries are going to have to become freer societies if they want to match us in space. And that will be a good thing. Okay? By putting power in the hands of the free, it will drive nations to become free. It's like, you know, why are there public schools? Okay, if you want to know, public schools were created, the first country to create universal public schools was Prussia, in order to have a good army, and everybody else copied them. And if you don't have universal public education, or at least universal literacy, you're going to be a third-rate country.
That's right. Good point.
Okay, so this was done, it wasn't done by people who just wanted to be nice. It was done by people who were forced to do it in order to compete.
Let's go to the phones now. Jerry in Georgia, welcome to the show. First-time caller. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, George. How you doing?
Okay.
Hi.
Hey, I'm going to just pass on some news to you tonight. My father-in-law used to work with NASA back in the Apollo program. Uh-huh. And he was the chief engineer on the lunar lander that went to the moon.
What, the Grumman? Was he with Grumman?
I'm not sure who he worked with. He had some association with Thiokol, but I'm not sure if it was at that time. But he had six members on his team, and they built that thing. And but he said one thing that they weren't able to test on the ground was firing that rocket engine on the ascent module enclosed inside that enclosure in that gravity and zero atmosphere. So they didn't know for sure that was going to work. He said everyone else celebrated when they landed. He said they celebrated, his team, when they got off the moon.
I see.
They must have been biting their nails.
There's something you just can't test. You have to actually do it.
That's true.
That's right. Everything they said, they were able to test everything except that. But he passed away yesterday.
Oh, sorry to hear that. Did he ever get upset when people said, we didn't go to the moon?
Yes. Yes, he did. And he looked at me and said, we went.
We sure did.
We went to the moon. I believe it. I think we did.
I've got a guest on next week that's going to talk a little bit about that. But that's amazing. We had some great Americans who got us to the moon, Robert, didn't we?
We sure did.
I mean, they were some. How did you get interested in space? What was that story for you?
Well, actually, it was Sputnik, if you want to know.
1957.
It's 1957. I was 5 years old. And I was already reading science fiction. And while to the adults, Sputnik may have been a terrifying thing, to me it was just tremendous because it meant all these stories about space travel were going to be true. And I just wanted to get into it right there.
That's fantastic. Joe, Long Island, New York. Hello, Joseph. Go ahead.
Hey, Rob, it'll take me a minute to ask my question. It's going over some material on the asteroid belt between Jupiter and Mars, and one of the things it was saying, Ceres, is some people had classified it as a dwarf planet recently. It's about 605 miles long. Then it was saying that the probes that we sent through there, we were worried about them hitting asteroids, but they said they found out it was only a 1 in a billion chance of that happening. And then they said there was different types of asteroids there. And then in the article it was saying that that now they're a little bit murky on the difference between asteroids and comets, and they think they're fairly closer to the same thing than previously thought. So I'd like to just ask you about that whole asteroid belt situation between Mars and Jupiter.
Okay, well, the main difference between asteroids and comets is what they're made of. Asteroids that are orbiting between Mars and Jupiter are mostly rock. And it can be different kinds of rocks.
Sure.
So ordinary rocks, there's things that are almost completely metal, there's are things that are almost organic in their material. That is, organic chemicals make them, and some of them do have some ice on them. But comets, while comets may have some rock and dust in them, are mostly ice. Okay? So comets are basically icebergs floating around, and asteroids are like islands. I mean, except they're not standing still like islands on Earth, but they're solid. And so the comets originate much further out in the solar system, in what's called the Kuiper Belt, or even further out, the Oort cloud. These are beyond Pluto. And out there, ice does not evaporate. So these things have been out there for billions of years, these ice balls, basically. And some of them can be quite large. Some of them can be as big as asteroids. A comet can be as massive as an asteroid, but it's made of ice or other frozen gases like ammonia. And then every once in a while, something happens that destabilizes one from its orbit, and they come zipping into the solar system from way out there. So they're on these very long elliptical orbits, and that's why most, you know, like Halley's Comet, we only see once every 76 years, and other comets really are on orbits that we only see them once every 1,000 years or 10,000 years because they fly so far out into interstellar space before they come back. But that's the main difference. But as they come into the inner solar system, the sun vaporizes some of their ice, and then sunlight actually has pressure. It has pushing power, and so the comet, the water vapor that vaporizes off the comet is pushed away from the comet in the direction away from the sun, creating a tail, which always points away from the sun.
They used to have a near-Earth tracking unit. The woman used to come on our program, Eleanor Helene, mm-hmm. and I haven't heard from her in a long time. And I assume we're still tracking these things, aren't we?
Well, yeah. And the real danger isn't so much from the comets, because most comets only come into the solar system, you know, every century or 10 centuries, 100 centuries. But there are what's called the near-Earth asteroids, which are asteroids that don't orbit between Mars and Jupiter, but actually have eccentric orbits that take them in as close to the sun as the Earth, or even closer. And so they're on elliptical orbits with maybe the inner part is halfway between Earth and Venus, and the outer part is halfway between Mars and Jupiter. But they're coming in, and they're coming into the inner solar system every couple of years. And, well, the solar system's a big place, so most of the time they don't come anywhere near close to the Earth. But every once in a while, one does. And the tiny ones of these, there's lots of tiny ones, they're called meteorites, and you can see them almost any night in the sky coming into the Earth's atmosphere. And, a sizable one hit the atmosphere over Pittsburgh a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. It rocked the whole place.
Yeah, and now that one was, for an asteroid, still very small, weighed a couple of tons. It had about the same explosive power as 30 tons of dynamite, okay? However, in December 2018, one hit the atmosphere over the Bering Sea with as 10 times the explosive power of the Hiroshima bomb.
That hurt people, too, didn't it?
No, I don't think that one did.
There was one over Russia. When was that one?
Oh, well, there were two in Russia in the past century, in the 20th century. One in Tunguska.
1908, right?
Yes. Now, that devastated thousands of square miles, and it undoubtedly killed many people and wild animals. But the area was not well settled, and the people who lived there were, you know, how can I put it, not well connected. They're Siberian.
They were peasants.
Yeah, or tribesmen or hunters.
Nothing wrong with peasants, but that's who they were, right?
Yes. Now, then there were, there was another one that hit Eastern Siberia in 1947, and that probably killed people as well. So the story here is that, and of course, a much bigger one hit the Earth 65 million years ago, and it devastated the whole planet and killed all the dinosaurs. We're descended from the survivors, little mammals that lived in burrows and basically had air.
That was a planet killer.
Yeah. We have to become spacefaring so we can take control of this flight traffic. In other words, if we're out there, if you're way out there, you give the asteroid a little push, you can make it miss the Earth.
What did you predict the terraforming of Mars would be? About 100 years it would take to terraform Mars?
Okay, well, this is not a prediction. This is a concept of how it could be done. In other words, things happen if people make them happen, and they don't happen if nobody makes it happen. Okay, so it's not a prophecy. It's just putting forth an idea of what we could do. And if we had human settlers on Mars, I think humans, being life, we all life forms try to turn their environments into places that are better for them. And life on Earth has radically improved the Earth as a home for life compared to how the Earth was originally. There was no oxygen in the Earth's atmosphere until plants put it there. You know, soil is a creation of life. Anyway, we go to Mars, we're going to want to improve it. Okay?
Sure, of course.
Now, the first thing we could do is warm the planet. And we know how to do that. We produce greenhouse gases. On Earth, we're trying to avoid greenhousing the Earth, but Mars needs to be greenhouses. And we know how to produce artificial greenhouse gases that are extremely powerful, and like carbon tetrafluoride, CF4. And if we were producing them, well, just to give you a sense, this would be a sizable operation. If you had 5,000 megawatts, which is about the same power as runs Chicago, and you were devoting that to running factories producing CF4, you could warm the planet by 10 degrees within 50 years. Now, if you did that, that's a lot of global warming, okay? We only have had 1 degree of global warming in the past 150 years. This would be 10 degrees in 50 years. That would warm the planet enough that lots of carbon dioxide that is currently soaked into the soil would outgas and thicken the atmosphere. And CO2 is also a greenhouse gas, as we know. And that would warm the planet another 50 degrees. Now, at that point, all the frozen water, not all of it, but a lot of the frozen water that Mars got, lots and lots of frozen water, massive glaciers, as far south as 38 degrees north, which is the latitude of San Francisco on Earth, glaciers come down. these would start to melt and water would run. There are dry riverbeds on Mars. There, rivers would flow again. The lakes would fill up. And then it would be rain. And at that point, you could start spreading plants all over the planet. So this is the sort of Mars that we could have in 100 years or so. Maybe a little longer if it takes a while before there's enough people on Mars to have an industrial effort on this scale. But 150 years. But then it will take longer to put enough oxygen in the atmosphere for people to breathe it. But even before that happens, you won't need to wear a spacesuit anymore. You just need breathing gear like scuba gear.
You're just like planet Earth. Let's go to Mike in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
George, good morning. Great to be with you. Great interview tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. How are you, George?
Everything's good.
Good, good. And Robert Zubrin, wow, it is really such an honor to speak with you. I really value your insight on Mars, so thank you. And I just had a very quick comment and question. So, Robert, there was an article in Popular Mechanics in which Elon Musk explained that in order to colonize Mars, we would have to first support life in glass domes at first before we eventually, you know, terraformed Mars to support life like on Earth. Elon went on to say glass panes with carbon fiber frames could actually be used to build these geodesic domes on the Martian surface, while mining droids actually could build pressurized caves underground. And, you know, I think it kind of really gets at the heart of the issue, being what would a habitable home environment look like on Mars? And I was just kind of wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Okay, well, that's a very interesting question. It's a very good one. And in fact, you know, the Mars Society over the past couple of years held a couple of contests for people to design first a 1,000-person Mars colony and then a 1,000,000-person Mars city-state. We had hundreds of entries, and the top 20 from each of them we published in books, once called Mars Colonies, and the other's called Mars City States. They're available on Amazon. And there are different concepts. So the one that Elon voiced is a good one. There's others building these into the sides of cliffs, you know, like the cliff dwellers, because the cliff will give you almost all the radiation protection you need, but you don't have to live underground. You can have the big view of the Grand Canyon, as it were. There are other people that came up with the concepts of if you can imagine living in an aquarium, not in the water, but under the tanks, so that, in other words, above you there are fish swimming in these glass tanks, and those are your fish farms, but they're also your radiation shielding.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Okay, and so you have a big transparent roof. You're under, you know, 30 feet of water, but plenty of water. Light gets down through 30 feet of water if you've ever scuba dived, and it's, you know, all lit up at that depth. And there's a lot of architects got involved, and they put forth some very exciting aesthetic concepts to deal with this idea of creating a beautiful city that nevertheless met all the technical requirements of living in an enclosed city with radiation protection from cosmic radiation. But yes, you could live underground. You could live in something like, you know, a subway system, or and of course, you know, there's places in some of the subway systems of the world that are like huge shopping malls. You know, that's one vision. And then there's these others. There's the one that Elon just put forward. There's this, living under the aquarium.
Hold on, Robert. We're going to come back. We'll chat more and take final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, psychic medium Erica Buzahar-Haney joins us as we talk about what is on the other side. And welcome back. Robert Zubrin with us. George Norrie here. Robert, if you could use a magic wand and wave it over NASA, what would you try to fix?
That's interesting. Number one, I would want NASA to embrace the goal of getting humans to Mars within 10 years. That is, and not, well, we will work on technologies that might be useful someday if someone had a human Mars program. okay? And this is how you get the bunk out of the program. You have people pushing all sorts of exotic technologies, saying you can't do your Mars mission until my program is complete, and they're just getting in the way. If you put the mission has to come first. If the mission comes first, then everything else falls into place. NASA needs a mission. The mission should be human to Mars, and the mission should come first.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Walter in Pennsylvania. Hello, Walt. Go ahead.
Hi, George. I'm still awake because I was on with Clyde Lewis. So, why, George, I sympathize with Mr. Subrin, you know, wanting to go to Mars. We'd all like to go places we've never been. But I remember I was telling Tom, the late Dr. Carl Sagan said that you get much more bang for your buck with unmanned spaceflight as opposed to manned, because obviously the great cost in spaceflight in manned exploration is providing for the redundant life support systems. And, you know, we're discovering, George, that in studying the astronauts that have been in space, that when you're subjected to, obviously, the radiation that they've been subjected to, and when they're deprived of the gravity, which our bodies have evolved to deal with the gravity on Earth, that there's all sorts of health problems that it causes.
There's no doubt. I had a story last night that they're finding out that they've got blood issues after they come down, too. But how do you feel about robotics versus an astronaut going there, Robert?
Well, if all you can do are robots, then do robots. But look, Stephen Squires, who is a geologist and who was the principal investigator on the Mars exploration rover mission, Spirit and Opportunities, said in testimony that there was nothing that they could do that he, as a geologist, could not do in 1/1000th the time, 1/1000th the time. And there were plenty of things that he could do that they could not do at all. And there's no comparison between the exploration capabilities of a human explorer and one of these robots. They're not remotely comparable. And if we're going to find life on Mars, we're going to need to send humans, because we're going to have to set up drilling rigs, drill down a kilometer, bring up water, take it into the lab, look for organisms, try to culture them. This is light years beyond the capability of robotic rovers. And then if we talk about, look, what we're really trying to do is not just explore space, we're trying to settle space. And that simply can't
happen. I mean, are we doing this one day in case we have to leave the planet?
Well, that's one benefit of it. But look, the benefit of Europeans coming to America was not to create a place that refugees could go to. That was one benefit. Refugees did have a place to go to. But the real benefit of America to the world was we created a new branch of human civilization that pioneered democracy and steamboats and telegraphs and electric light bulbs and electric power and recorded sound and motion pictures and aeroplanes and nuclear power and computers and the internet. I mean, that's what it is. You create new branches of human civilization, then humanity as a whole becomes stronger and richer.
Next up, Jeff in Ferguson, Missouri is with us. Hey, Jeffrey, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Robert, I got a question about the Starship program by SpaceX.
Sure.
Yeah.
Are they developing a military version for Space Force for military applications? Like maybe,
well, they don't have to develop a special military version. It's a rocket that can deliver 100 tons of cargo to orbit, and that cargo can be a space station or it can be a fleet of reconnaissance satellites. It can be or it could be a human mission to Mars. So the it's a transportation system. So, you know, we use railroads to send passengers, to send freight, and to send troops. They do all those things. And this is a railroad to space.
Eric's with us, truck driving in Indiana now. Hello, Eric.
Hello, George. How are you this morning?
Good. Keeping America going. Go ahead, kid.
Yes, sir. I want to ask your guest about what he knows about Area 51.
What do you know about that, Robert?
Yeah, Area 51. I actually do know something about Area 51. And it is the secret of Area 51, if you want to know, is that there's 3,000 people that work there and they do absolutely nothing. And you're paying their salaries.
Now, when you say they do absolutely nothing, what do you mean by that?
I mean they do nothing.
What do they do? What are they doing there?
Well, this is a place that they used to test atom bombs underground 50 years ago. And that was outlawed about half a century ago. And so we still maintain it in case we ever want to resume underground atom bomb testing. And you've got 3,000 salaried federal employees going there to work every day and being paid good salaries to do nothing.
Do you believe in extraterrestrial visitations here? I mean, you're a scientist and you're a pragmatic person.
I don't believe that in the UFOs are extraterrestrial spacecraft that are visiting the Earth.
You do not.
Okay? I do believe that there are extraterrestrial civilizations, thousands of them throughout the galaxy.
They just haven't come here yet, you think?
Right.
What about these incredible Tic Tac videos and things like that?
Well, I happen to know that some of the UFO, in the 50s when this thing was really set off, what that was, at that time, the United States wanted to do reconnaissance missions over the Soviet Union, and this was before there were satellites. So what they did was they had balloons that carried cameras and that could stay aloft long enough to fly all across the Soviet Union from Europe, and then they would reach Alaska, and they would drop the cameras loaded with film, and we'd be able to see things. Now, what would happen is they would have tests of these, and some farmer would see this big glowing mass up in the sky, and they'd reach the press. And in order to discredit them, in order to basically weird them out, they had Air Force pilots step forward and say, no, that was no balloon. That moved at Mach 25 and then did 90-degree turns. No balloon could do that. And if you look at, and I once actually did a study of this, all the most credible UFO claims of the 50s and 60s, that is, you know, the ones where, you know, the UFO community, you know, they understood that some of these claims were like people seeing Venus behind a cloud or something. And they, you know, said, okay, look, forget about that one. That's not the ones we want
to
make a big deal about, okay, because that's just Venus behind a cloud. But this, you can't explain. Almost all of those were reports by U.S. Air Force officers. They were not reports by civilian pilots. They were not reports by Canadian pilots. They were not reports by Navy pilots. There was an institutional bias behind the reports, okay, which basically meant what said to me was this was an Air Force fraud. And guess what? In the 80s, the Smithsonian Institute published a book called Project Moby Dick, which was about this balloon program, and they mentioned exactly this. So that's what now, of course, this we're talking now about the balloon program of the 50s, which inspired many of the classic UFO sightings.
And it was also called Project Mogul, I think, right?
Maybe. I'm
pretty sure.
That, but. Okay, but anyway, so that's what I think these things are. And I think that the UFO reports are of you know, the ones that are really the significant ones are almost all reported by military pilots, and I believe that they are efforts to take civilian sightings of secret military aircraft and push them into a realm of, you know, paranormal discussions that mainstream people don't take seriously.
All right, let's go to final calls. Orson's with us in Pennsylvania. Welcome to the show. Hello, Orson.
Good evening. It's being reported that Buzz Aldrin has tripped and broken his hip tonight on his birthday. As he was being put in an ambulance, he's quoted as yelling, "Gravity sucks, don't get old, and this doesn't happen on the moon."
Now is this for real?
Yes, it is.
Oh, my God.
Godspeed, Space Cowboy.
Exactly.
Wow.
Okay, thanks. I got to check into that. See if that. I hope he didn't break his hip. My God. Shane in Melbourne, Australia, welcome to the program. Shane, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, g'day, George. When I was a boy, George, I'd hear this thing coming from the idiot box, the TV set, and, you know, with the American shows we'd be watching, and there'd be one that really caught me, and I really believed in it because of the Kennedy at the time, but it was truth, justice, and the American way.
Yeah.
Well, George, you are a great representative of that for the American people.
Well, thank you, Shane.
And g'day, Robert.
G'day.
Yeah, look, Robert, my concern is in the last 2 years, the Australian population's been locked down under, like, a martial law. And now with the satellites going up, 1,800, did you say?
1,500 at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It must launched 1,800 satellites over the past several years.
Right. Well, you know, they say Musk, but if all the militaries in the world are allowing that to happen, then, you know, there's a few other parties involved in those satellites. And my main concern is, Robert, with the lockdown and our sort of rights have been deteriorating, do you believe that these satellites could be used for population control?
Well, only in the sense that any communication system can be used for any purpose.
Interesting.
What Musk is building is basically a cell phone system that anyone anywhere in the world, in the middle of the outback, in Australia, in the middle of the ocean, they'd be able to pick up a phone and call anybody. And Zoom call anybody and access the internet. All that stuff would be anywhere. And that's what he's doing. And such a communication system could be used for any purpose, good or evil.
Let's go out to Paul in Buffalo, where they got about 2 feet of snow. Paul, you digging out there?
I'm already dug out, George. You know, we got about 18 inches at my house, and I'm in North Buffalo in one night. And that's a lot for one night, but if anyone's equipped for it, it is us Buffalo.
That's true.
let me begin tonight to the greatest audience in the world, the Coast audience, with two very specific predictions. On February 4th, to coincide with the opening of the Olympic Games, Vladimir Putin will go hot and invade Ukraine.
Oh,
and on February 13th, ending 62 years of futility, the Buffalo Bills will win the Super Bowl. My point about NASA, earlier in the show, you correctly said we cannot name astronauts, but we can name Spirit and Curiosity the rovers because they actually do exploring. Right now, our astronauts have been telescope mechanics for the last 20 years, and I don't say that to deride them. I say that as a statement of fact. When, as your guest has said, we need human explorers, and it will be inspiring, and the whole world will watch them, George, as we rightly should, when humans are on the moon again or on any other celestial body.
Absolutely. And I hope the kids in school, the great kids, just have a fervor for space and space travel. Do you think that could happen, Robert?
Yes. And as far as what the caller said, I agree. We have to give the astronauts a job that's worthy of them. And then, yes, and then they will be famous, and the benefit of that, by the way, is not, okay, you're an astronaut, now you can be famous. It's that for these kids, their heroes will be heroes of science, heroes of progress, instead of, the rock stars that take off their clothes at the Super Bowl or something. I mean, you know, the people who actually, heroes worth looking up to.
Absolutely. Robert, we only have about a minute left for people who want your books. What's the best spot for them to get them?
Well, I guess Amazon is the most easy place to go to, or barnesandnoble.com. So I've got a number of books. Okay, the two best-known ones are The Case for Mars and The Case for Space. I also wrote a book called How to Live on Mars.
You
and
did.
It's sort of
That's
a
right.
humorous book. It's a guide to immigrants to Mars from an old hand, and he's kind of a scoundrel. He is always looking to cut corners, but he tells them all the tricks about how to become rich and famous on Mars, how to pick up girls on Mars, how to do anything you need to do on Mars. And so it's kind of a fun book. So there's The Case for Mars, The Case for Space, and How to Live on Mars.
What is your next project, my friend?
I'm working on a book called The Case for Nukes. It's about nuclear power.
Which, of course, people are trying to do away with.
Well, yeah, and it's kind of funny, isn't it? Because the people who are trying to do away with it are the people that are always screaming about global warming. Okay, you know, if it wasn't for the environmentalists, practically the whole American electric grid would be nuclear right now, which is to say it would be a zero-carbon grid. Exactly the problem that they say needs to be solved would already be solved, as it has been solved in France. And you want to know something? That's why I think they hate nuclear power, because it would solve a problem they need to have.
Robert, thanks again for being on the program. Keep in touch. Let us know when that latest book is up. Up next, a psychic medium talks about clairvoyance.